You're with Lembit Opic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Lembit Opic here. Welcome to today's News Talk TNT with me, Lembit Opic, on my four-hour marathon, as always, at a weekend on Saturdays and Sundays. Though I'll tell you about that in just a minute. So glad you could join me. So good evening to my friends in Australia. Good morning to my friends in Britain and all points in between as well. In a great show today, and I would say that, wouldn't I? We've got everything from filmmaking to calling a whistle on torture, to the world of investment and my favourite subject, the non-existent climate crisis. We'll be covering all of that in the next 4 hours, but this show is nothing without you. We need your points of view as well. Go to tntradio.live and you will find a cornucopia of ways of getting in touch. We've got phone numbers there if you want to call in. And then there's the good old trusty chat. I'll come to that in just a minute, actually, because there's quite a lot of debate about how much I should read out and report from the chat in yesterday's show. The first guest will be Melvin Marks. He's a fascinating fellow. He works in film finance and other finance too. And well, we'll see where that goes. I think it's interesting. I declare an interest. I make films myself. In fact, I've been working on one of them over the weekend. Melvin and I first met in that context. So we'll talk about that a little bit as well. Then later on, we've got a musician. Last week, regular viewers will know, I was having a rant about what I thought was the disgrace of the Eurovision Song Contest. That's the biggest music show in the world. And in my view, it's now the worst as well. When I was growing up, it was a family entertainment. Now it's anything but. Can the music world be redeemed? Well, my guest will be talking about that. Fascinating fellow, actually. Lovely guy. And tipped to be one of the big names of 2024, 2025. Then we will be speaking with Philip Diaz. Philip Diaz a bit later on. He is the director of I Am Gitmo. It's a film about torture in Guantanamo Bay. I want to emphasize the quality of this film. I haven't seen all of it yet. I've watched some of it, but it's compulsive viewing for those of us who aren't completely convinced about the moral probity of the West when we preach to other countries about human rights abuses. And before him, we got Harry Wilkinson from the Net Zero Watch organization. I'll be continuing a dialogue that I'm having with the world about the non-existent climate crisis. Anybody who's been watching Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, and indeed the Southern Lights, they got those in the south of the South Pole as well, will know the power of the sun, where you might have something like 1,000 gigawatts of energy just bouncing around in the sky. Well, I'll be talking to Harry maybe about that, but mainly about the continuing decline and fall of those who are claiming that there's a climate crisis. Where are they now? Where were they when it was snowing in Moscow? All of that with me, Lembit Opic. Before we do go to our first guest, though, I'm very keen on talking with you about this. Well, there's two things, really. What one of them is about the reality of how we do the show. There was an interesting process point, and I wouldn't normally bring this up, but I'm genuinely interested in this in the context of free speech, a conversation perhaps we only need to have once. Some were saying, oh, I shouldn't read out every single thing that's put out there. Well, I don't read out every single thing that's put into the chat, but I do like to involve you, partly because you have thoughts which I haven't had. And if you don't want me to read something out, just simply put privately or not for broadcast, but I hope you don't do that, because this is a global conversation, a place where the world really can repossess freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And that's really why I tend to read those things out. So you let me know if you think it's too much or too little. It's not a democracy on this one, I have to tell you. I'm inclined always to overshare on these things rather than undershare, because I want you to feel that you're part of the conversation. Same way that you can call as well. I'm just wondering also if you have the view that I do, that it's very difficult to enforce censorship if you, in an uncensored way, keep talking with the public. In fact, Just a Bloke says keep engaging with the Hang on a sec. It jumps around quite a lot when people keep putting stuff in. It says keep engaging with the public. Well, I hope that I can and I will do that. That's very very good from my point of view. Keep engaging with the chat, Lambert, says Just a Bloke. Good morning to you, bloke. Excuse my rudeness for not saying hello earlier, says Lord Melbury. Are you saying we aren't the good guys, says Wheat Fat Shug? I'm not sure what that refers to because I haven't scrolled up beyond that. And so you let me know what you think and I'll draw a judgment. It'll be an opinion on my part, but I've been in the broadcasting industry one way or another for 40 years. So hopefully I'll have some idea what to do about it. One more about Lord Melbury. He says the only crisis about climate change destroying the planet is the number of people who believe this nonsense. I totally agree with you, Lord Melbury. I think you'll find Harry Wilkinson a breath of fresh air. That's going to be a fantastic discussion with Harry. You haven't had him on for a while, actually. So I'm looking forward to that, too. Just a couple of stories I want to cover before we go to my first guest. I've noticed that there's been quite a big debate about when the United Kingdom bombs places and when it doesn't. Yesterday, I had the former leader of the British National Party, Nick Griffin, who has been a very controversial character in British politics, but I find him very interesting. And I also find his insights a rare treat because nobody else seems to want to give him the airtime. And he said, in short, that he helped the Syrian government essentially convince the British Parliament not to support a military intervention in aspects of the Syrian conflict. In short, it seems that Nick Griffin pretty much single-handedly from the UK side, worked with the Syrians to prevent a bloodbath and one which would have empowered a terrorist organisation. Now, you'll have to watch the show again to see the details. I haven't got time to recap the whole thing. But this is what happens when you silence people. You don't hear the backstory of historical events. I'm in no doubt that yesterday was something of an exclusive for me personally, and I follow the news closely. Because I'd never heard Nick Griffin explain that before. Had it not been for him, the UK would have been involved in yet another bloody conflict in the Middle East, and one which would probably have served to further destabilise the Middle East. That's what we haven't heard, because people didn't want you to think that Nick Griffin had done some good. And that's the problem when you personalise everything in politics. So that's my first observation now. The second one goes to a rather strange debate which is taking place about Britain's involvement with the Israeli situation and the Ukrainian situation. Somebody asked on the mainstream media today, why is it that the UK was able to apprehend missiles aiming for Israel, but doesn't seem so willing to apprehend missiles aimed at Ukraine? Now, I'm not getting into the ins and outs of those wars. We'll do that on another occasion. But it's quite obvious to me what's going on here. The UK is not scared of Iran so much, though it maybe should be, because Iran is a regional superpower, but it is scared of Putin. And we make these judgments on a pragmatic basis, maybe less on the rights and wrongs of these situations and more on what we can get away with and what might play out well in general elections. I don't think that's a cynical point, because I was on the inside myself when British Parliament voted in great majority for the unforgivable intervention in Iraq 2 decades ago. I voted against that. I was a member of Parliament. I voted against it. And I was pariahed. As it turns out, I was proved right, together with a small number of us who had the courage to stand against the conformity. All of this is to say that if you watch the British news now, wherever you live in the world, I think you'll increasingly see this dilemma, this contradiction in terms coming from politicians who are actually trying to work out what's best for them in the election. Here's my advice for you candidates. George Galloway, who comes from the left of politics, defeated the Labour Party in a by-election, largely, in my view, because he unequivocally opposed the war and the military intervention in Gaza. Labour Party supported it and opposed the ceasefire. Also, I believe that the Green Party, which did well in the local elections in the United Kingdom a few weeks ago, didn't do well because of its environmental policies, which I consider to be balmy and unenforceable. So balmy, in fact, that the Scottish National Party has now broken rank with its former coalition partners, the Greens. No, I think they did well because they also opposed military action in Gaza. They support a ceasefire. So my second observation this Sunday morning, if you're in the UK, is this. Peace sells better than war. And as far as I'm concerned, regardless of the ins and outs of who's right and who's wrong in these situations, they always need a non-military solution. They always need some kind of negotiation. That's what we learned about creating a lasting peace after World War II. That's what we learned when creating an unstable peace between North and South Korea. And that's certainly what we learned in Vietnam, where might wasn't right, and actually the West lost. I'd like to hear your views on this as well, of course. I will read out some of them if I can. But you're most welcome to get involved in the conversation. Go to tntradio.live, have your say. And you can also have the, well, in my view at least, the freedom, which I will vociferously protect, to agree, disagree, suggest, oppose, or simply make a comment that no one has thought of before. Wherever you are in the world, this is the home of free speech. That's what today's News Talk TNT is all about. And that's what these 4 hours are about too. So without further ado, let me get to my first free thinker. It's Melvin Marks. Melvin, good morning to you. I heard you coughing in the background there. Hope you weren't choking on my words.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah, I'm fine, thanks.
Good. Thanks for having me on. Thanks. Well, thanks for joining us, actually. Before we talk, I'm not going to, unless you want to, I'm not going to talk about war so much. You're a man of finance, and that's how I first came across you. And I find your views on this very, very interesting. So before we go any further, tell us about yourself, who you are, what do you do, and why do you do it?
Let's start from the beginning. I first started work at 16. I went to a very good school, and but be quite honest with you, I wasted it. I had too much of a good time. I was okay in the sciences, did very well, and like mathematics and stuff like that, passed the exams there. Because that was, I found that interesting. When I actually did subjects like history and geography, where I had to remember so much stuff and didn't have to work out anything, I found it, if you like, boring. And I got left behind, and I didn't get any A-levels. Well, didn't get the chance to get any A-levels, even get into the sixth form. So I had to find a job, as it was years ago. So at 16, through a family friend, I was offered an interview at a stock jobber, which is similar to a stockbroker, which I'll go into later. Anyway, I went around this guy's house. He was going to give me the interview. And the first thing he said to me was, get your hair cut. Because I was had this long, curly hair. You can't believe that now, can you? But I had this long, curly hair. Says, get your hair cut or you're getting no interview. Anyway, he told me what the job was entailed, and he made it sound horrible. I mean, really, really tough. And I still fancied it. As I was walking out the house, I could feel my father getting a pair of scissors ready to cut my hair. That's how. But anyway, this is the interview, Lem, that used to get years ago in stockbroker's office, if you like. I walked in, sat down. I met the office manager, who really ran the firm. He wasn't a director or a partner, but he ran the firm because he knew what was going on in every aspect of the firm. And he interviewed me in a striped shirt, white collar, years ago, if you remember, tie, red braces, and he was smoking a cigarette while he was interviewing me. Basically, that was the interview. What's your name? Yeah. You're all right. Yeah, yeah. See you Monday. And that was it. It took about 5 minutes. So from then I had to work in the office, and it was basically do this, do that, get that done, bring that over here. And we used to have to check that all the stocks that we dealt in, we had the correct position, because being a stock jobber, we were like the middlemen, the wholesaler. So we might buy 50,000 shares one day in one stock, sell approximately 30,000. So we should have 20,000 on the book. If we had a different amount, we had to go and search what went wrong. Who are we not agreeing with? Anyway, so then after a few years, they look at you as you're in the office. You're being tested the whole time, really, what your personality is like, if they think you can actually go on the market floor, where everything was fantastic. It was a fabulous place. What you did after a while, if someone the next stage up for me would have been on the market floor is what they call a blue button. It's a runner, really, giving messages to brokers, getting messages back, getting the books, getting the bargains written up, what you've done. It was all paper and pencil years ago. No electronic thing. It was all basically back of a cigarette packet to a degree. So that was the job. And after you were a blue button, if they thought you had it in you, because it is quite a tough thing down there, you had to be able to give it and take it to a degree. You couldn't give it as a blue button because you were the lowest of the food chain. They wanted to see how you took it. And if they thought you could take it, and also you had something about you that to understand the way the market works, because you were listening, you had to listen and look the whole time what the dealers did. They made you up to a dealer. So one day the boss called me in of the whole firm who I was working under, strangely enough, because it's all different, what they call pitches. There might be an electrical pitch, a store pitch, textile pitch, which I work, that was where I mainly worked. And he called me and he says, how do you think you've done this year? So I said, yeah, all right, sir. Really? We think you've been useless. Absolutely useless. I thought, I don't think I have. I've been all right. He says, so useless. We're making you up to dealer next week. So that was the way it was. It was absolutely brilliant. I mean, it was one of those places where, believe me, the business that went on was hard. It was tough. It was stressful at times, but it was a pleasure to work in that place. And there were times where you had a chance to just enjoy yourself. It was like a club. It was like a club. I'll give you a couple of instances. There was one guy who I didn't really see him deal a lot. He was a broker. He used to come onto our pitch and a few others. And he was a magician. He just used to do tricks the whole day long. And one of the tricks he did, if you find someone new in the market that hadn't seen him, he'd get an old penny. And this is before Elf and Safety, Lembit. Just to lick it, stick it on your forehead, press it in and go to the guy, right, you've got three chances to knock it off your forehead. Don't move your forehead. Just bang the back of your head three times and you've got to catch it in your hand. So the guy goes, bang, does it three times. It doesn't move. He says, look, you've been a bit unlucky. I'll do it again. And the guy does it again. He's the guy that's doing this is the only guy that doesn't realise he hasn't actually got a penny on his forehead at all. And he's put it on. He's taken it off. And everyone in the market's looking around. They can see what's happening, but no one says anything. And this guy's banging the back of his head. It was brilliant. And another thing, I mean, there's so many stories I can go on throughout, but I won't. Another story, which was quite funny. World War II, there was two partners of a firm. It was what they call the gilt market, which you know about. They were partners of this firm. There's only the two partners. They had people working for them. They were the two main partners. They went to war, and one of them came back, and he won the Victoria Cross. And the other brother won the Distinguished Flying Cross. So you know what they nicknamed the guy who got the brother that got the Distinguished Flying Cross? You know what they nicknamed him?
Go on.
You'll never guess. The Coward. Because he got just one under the top. And he was known by that name, the Coward. And it could have been brutal. If you walked in on the market floor, and it was quite tough sometimes, they had what they call waiters to stop the... Because the waiters knew you had a badge on your lapel and they knew most of the people anyway. But if someone came in and by mistake just got through the door and they look around like, where do I go? People would actually go up to them and cut their tie. It's really? Wicked. Yeah, honestly, yeah. So cut their tie.
I worked about, must have been 10 years ago. I worked in an office in the city, a small office. It was to do with training. But next door, there was some kind of stockbroker operation going on. And all you could hear was whooping and screaming and swearing. And then suddenly everyone would bang all the tables. And it sounded to me like an animal farm. It sounded to me like the baying blood, sort of curdling cockfighting of the past. I thought that if I go in there, I'll just see people drinking and doing probably illegal things. And this is dripping with testosterone. Now, what you're saying doesn't persuade me that it is that I'm wrong. It sounds to me that's what it was like.
I don't believe. I mean, I started working in the 70s. I don't believe there was drug taking or such thing. Plenty of drinking. Don't get me wrong. There was a heavy drinking culture going on then. but not so much drugs. That came a bit later. But on the floor itself, on a Sunday night, you couldn't wait to get to work, if that sounds mad. It was just, you're seeing a lot of friends. People, well, there's a guy now that I'm still friendly with that I met 40, 50 years ago from the market floor. We're not even on the same firm, but he used to come up to me and ask me prices, because I was like one of the wholesalers there. We're like the market boys. We buy it off A and sell it, hopefully sell it to B at a higher price. And it was so, I won't say it's unprofessional, because that's not fair, but it was so non-technical. Uh-huh. When a company results came out, it didn't flash up the results. You had a bell go off, and you had to run. It had the name of the company. You had to run, or the blue button did. That was one of his jobs. Run to one of the walls where the company announcements came out, and it was printed on the wall. They just stuck it on the wall, and the blue button had to write down pre-tax profit, tax, dividend, and any statement that the chairman might have made. Then he had to run back to where his boss was to make the price. The boss would look at it, right, and bang, he'd make a price straight away. Nowadays, you've got analysts, you've got, you know, filters, you've got, it's all so, so different. So that was quite exciting times, because you'd make a price and there'd be a crowd of you, absolute crowd around waiting for the first price to come. They want you to make the wrong price. They want you to say the stock is 119, say, when they had orders to buy them at 124. They want to make the wrong price. They could trade, not the right price. But it was so exciting sometimes. I was on the floor, and the Queen came in with Prince Charles. They stood right by us. They mean to come in, obviously. But they're supposed to go on a round exchange, and they just happened to stand. It was unbelievable. And I had a little chat with Prince Charles. Duke of Edinburgh did. Not Prince Charles, Duke of Edinburgh did. He chatted to my boss. My boss was so calm. He wasn't ready for it. He didn't expect it.
Exciting times. Hold that thought. I'm going to go to break. And this is fascinating. I've learned more about Melvin Marks in the last 10 minutes than I've learned in the last 5 years. Quite remarkable. He's a bit of a one. Don't go anywhere. I've got some comments to read out as well, not least about Nick Griffin, actually. And Lord Melbury, I get it. You like Nick Griffin, not Nick Clegg. I second that emotion. I understand it. Nick Clegg ruined my party. Do keep your calls and comments coming. Go to tntradio.live chat. And also you'll find the phone numbers if you want to call in. Shortly, I'm going to ask Melvin Marks, who does film financing as well as other things, what he considers to be the state of the creative arts world and generally finance. He's a bit of an expert on that. So if you've got questions on that as well, do use this opportunity to get some free perspective from a man who's been in the trade for decades. I'm Len Batopic. This is TNT. Today's News Talk. See you after the break.
TNT's Jason Allbourne.
These strange political decisions being put upon us. Now, are we all going mad, or is there another side that's being suppressed to the point that, in fact, we're indeed facing a hidden hand that we don't quite know what the agenda is?
The border in the United States used to be porous. It took Donald Trump 3 years to close it. And now there is no border. There's 10 million people have crossed the border, and we have no idea who they are. It'll cost, some suggestions, $500 billion. They're demanding, they protest in Denver, they demand free food, free ethnic food, etc. We have 1 million foreign students, quarter million from the Middle East, 250,000 from China. Half of the students that are arrested on our campus are not students. They tend to be from the Middle East.
Weekends with Jason Allbourne on today's News Talk. TNT.
The Light is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. Thelightpaper.co.uk.
Now I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Lembotopic Show, where I am with Melvin Marks, who has had quite a colourful financial life, which continues. Before we go back to Melvin, let me read some of the comments, which I judge you do want to hear. Wee Fat Shug says that Nick Griffin was impressive. He was on a UNN a month or two back and was very impressive, very intelligent. I think so. I think he's a very interesting character. And I think that the mainstream media really misses a trick by not giving him the chance to have debate. You can have a robust debate with him. I do. I challenge him about things that I have a difference of agreement with him about. But the whole point about free speech is that you make up your mind. I don't censor who you listen to. I just expect you to be smart enough to decide what's right and what's not. A few points here. Just a Bloke says, this is a lovely, lovely comment. Lembit, if everyone is thinking the same, no one is thinking at all. And I think that's absolutely right. A little praise, by the way, from Mr. Ant. First time listening to Kate Semirani. Brilliant, brave, compassionate truth. Absolutely right. Kate is a real absolute delight to be in the same stable with. Lord Melbury says, just about my views on war, the UK thinks it's still a military world power and still behaves like it. Such as are the idiots we have in power. All bark and no bite because the teeth were removed after World War II. Holly says, morning all, lovely day so far. Asparagus for breakfast. Holly, you have to do something different for breakfast every time. I've just settled on oats. And it makes me feel fantastic. Good for cholesterol, I'm told, as well. And just one more. Wee Fat Chuck says, Mustaine was spot on. Even way back then, peace sells, but who's buying? Wee Fat Chuck, you are definitely on a roll today. Do keep your calls and comments coming. Lord Melbury says something which brings us right back to the finance discussion I'm having with Melvin Marks. Not the Rothschilds and other predatory bankers. It's a good point. Good morning, Hermetica, as well. Boy, you guys are busy now. I'm going to have to go back to my guest, I'm afraid. Melvin Marks, you have certainly lived the dream that many people, certainly people of my generation, dreamt of. The greed is good, 1980s Gordon Gekko days. It's changed since then, though, hasn't it, Melvin? I want to talk about film financing as well in a minute, but has the mood of this sector changed? I know you've changed jobs, but you must still have contacts.
Yes, but I saw the change when Big Bang happened. It was totally different. Everything was so different after that, because instead of it being a market where London was predominantly a very big market and we were trading in all our own stocks, all of a sudden it was American stocks we're dealing in. And we didn't have what I call complete control of the market. You had American banks coming in and they had their own ways of dealing. And all of a sudden, instead of me being against, say, three or four other jobber firms when I make a price, because that's what it was all about, you had 10 and 15. And it all depends who got hold of the order to what the share price did. People had different ideas of how to trade, where mostly in the old days when it was on the floor, people probably traded very similar ways, but sometimes it was get the order done, don't care about the price. I'm not saying it happened all the time, but we had that feeling sometimes. And the orders from, say, the States were so big that we couldn't afford to take them on sometimes. And that's why the prices moved so much quicker over the time. You're talking about Gekko, they were the times when it was big money and also it was enjoyable. Once the actual Big Bang kicked in, then it was bigger money, but nowhere near as enjoyable. It really did change. I mean, I was lucky because I was in the stock exchange. I loved what I did, and so did a lot of people. Just loved what they did. It was a fantastic way to make money. Everyone, you know, you had your bad times as well, where you said, well, what am I doing here? The market's gone down. My boss is going to be on, when I get back to the office, the boss is going to say to me, why have you bought this stock and it's gone down? And you know, every day you're losing money for the last few days. But overall, it was a great place to be. And though, as I said before, there was a drinking culture, very much so. And people used to go out sometimes at 11 o'clock for a pint, come back, 1 o'clock, then went out to lunch and had quite a few pints. I mean, it was a very, 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 you know, drink orientated culture. But just one more story before we talk about something else, about another thing that happened. There was a broker in the market who always wasn't very trustworthy, put it that way. When he told you he had an order in X, it was probably 4X. And what you used to do, just very quickly, when you traded with a market maker or a jobber, as it was then, the idea was you traded with one person until you got the order done or you got released so you could deal with somebody else. This guy didn't believe in those rules. He was an old boy. He probably just did his own thing and people couldn't stand him. Anyway, one day, what you used to do, when you did some good business with somebody, you used to invite him out for lunch. Would you like a lunch or would you like to come up to the office? We've got a big lunch going on. I'd like you to be the guest. So this guy came on the pitch, asked the price. I said, by the way, would you like lunch with us next week? He goes, really? Because no one asked him for lunch. No one liked him. He was a bit of a wrong one, if you like, but not a nice wrong one. He was a, you know, not a nice character. Yeah. Where's that? Come to our office next week, next Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Oh, thank you very much. Anyway, this is how it used to work. Remember, used to go up to the office, meet a few other people from the market, and someone would say, what would you like to drink? And you had a drink before lunch at the bar, and you used to sit down and be waiters, and waitresses come around and give you your food, and it's all lovely, more wine, brandy, and pool. Anyway, the guy went up there, he's looking around, seeing all these people from the market, and the guy goes, right, what would you like to drink? He goes, I'd like a gin and tonic, please. Oh, right, no problem. He goes back, hands him his drink, he says, you've given me a whiskey and coke. I ordered gin and tonic. He says, yes, but you always lie.
I had to win friends and influence people.
Yeah, exactly.
I came from a different background. In my old company, which is Procter & Gamble, a big international American company, it was always about showing respect even to your enemies or your opponents. As I say, I'm not sure I'd have been cut out for the cut and thrust that you've been through. Incidentally, a very good comment here. Lord Melbury says, the guilt market sounds like something to do with war criminals. I think
Market was war loan. It's what the government used to borrow off the public by selling gilts or bonds, and one of them was the war loan. So it had to do with a war.
Not far away from it. Here's another one. I don't expect you to comment on this one, Melvin. Lord Melbury says, Nick Clegg ate my hamster. Okay, well, prove it. I know what you're referring to. Holly says I'm in a stable. At least he hasn't called me lamb chop. Actually, normally it does. Hermetica says that is exactly the problem, Lembit. If we had free speech, we could make up our own minds, and that's exactly what they don't want. Which is why I read out your comments, folks, because I just read them and say I only take the swear words out. Otherwise, I read them as they say. Lots of technical questions there as well, but you have to read them for yourselves. And peace sells, but who's buying? Was Dave Mustaine, maybe 87, can't remember. Loved it as a 21-year-old and played it loud as my wee speakers could play, says Truth Will Out. Now I broadcast it so loud in my W shop and let the world hear it. There's a song that you might remember. Oh, sorry. Mogden's doubtful about my views on cholesterol. I'm not completely convinced about it myself, to be honest with you, but I'm trying oats because I like oats. The song I like, Melvin, I don't know if you're of the generation I am, is The Truth Will Not Be Televised. The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. It is being televised. Everything's being televised now. And that brings me to what you do. One of the things you do is financing. And indeed, our paths vicariously crossed through a third party because of that. The financing world, though, how do you make the decisions? And I'm saying this because last week I had a real downer about the Eurovision Song Contest. I thought it was a farce and I thought it was a disgrace. But obviously there's plenty of money in it. How do you make judgments about what to invest in, especially in the dangerous world of broadcasting?
It is very precarious. I mean, a lot of people, and I can't talk to myself necessarily, but a lot of people nowadays want to buy something or invest in something that's past the winning post. And that's the problem we've got. Risk reward goes out the window. If you're asking people to put up money and risk their money, their capital, and it is so difficult to get people. Years ago, it was much easier. But I think since the crash, and interest rates resumed up. We saw that happen. But the confidence goes, and it's like a deflated balloon. It will come back again in certain areas, it will, but it's a bit of a catch-22. If you've got a very good name, if you've been successful in the past, you will get the finance far, obviously, far easier than if you've got this amazing idea, which will do so well, but no one has seen your work before. How do you get the first one over the line? That's the difficult thing, isn't it? And I think I've seen that more and more with quite a few people. I don't think it's even about the money sometimes. Yes, it is money, but you can raise, it might be hard to raise £250,000, but much easier for some reason to raise £3 million, £4 million, because it's what that person represents. Because, oh yeah, I've seen that, he's got these ties, I've seen that. It's not as good, but it probably will be as good. Whereas you've got something absolutely tip top. Sometimes it's difficult to get that idea over a desk. You can't push it across the desk and look at this. They go, well, I'll see you later, or I've got other people to talk to. It is so, so difficult. And it's a shame. It's an absolute shame. But going forward, who knows?
Yeah, this is the thing. As you know, I make short films, and I'm trying to make a long film at the moment in Greece. And it seems to, and I know it's a very, very strong script, and it's all worked well so far. The challenge I've had is getting that first investment. I have no doubt, once I've had one, people will be throwing money at me to make more.
That's right.
To what extent is it a lottery? Or is it guesswork? Is it a gamble? Or is there actually some kind of method in it?
There is a method in it, obviously, but with everything, there is a gamble. And what people have got to weigh up is, I know it's a gamble, but is it a 99%er or is it a 50%er? That's what you've got to actually, in your mind, think. Think the upside against the downside and what the chances, percentage-wise. There's one thing that I'm slightly involved with, to do with football. And it's absolutely fantastic. It really is a great idea. But you don't know, something could be a great idea, but if the public doesn't think it's sexy, it's not going to happen. This situation, it's got a lot of backing. They've managed to get the finance. They've got some fantastic people working on it. But in my heart of hearts, will it work? I believe it will work. Am I 100%? Of course not. Am I 95%? I reckon it's 85-90, I would put that down to, of actually being a very big success. And it's horses for courses, because some things you say, who's going to be interested? But you may not be interested, but the majority might be interested, or more people, or an amount of people might be interested to make it work. So it's a bit, as you say, gut feeling. It's your brain and your heart sometimes as well. And your experience of saying, I've seen this before, something similar. I can't see this as any different to something else that has failed.
That means that you must. I've got a dead cert, 100% certain. So, can you get me the £4 million?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, just I'll have to. You have to give me a couple of days, though.
You can have a whole week if you want. the arts and the film industry used to have incredibly attractive tax breaks. They seem to have been cut down a bit. Is that good or bad?
Well, it's bad, isn't it? I mean, you want investment. The idea is investment. People take a chance. Why shouldn't they be rewarded? Risk reward, as I say. If you've got a chance of putting X amount in and your losses are less than that, why not? It seems to... I think sometimes governments look at the wrong angle. They're not, just because you're in government doesn't mean you're an expert on any particular area. You know, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, whoever that is, going back 50 years, may not have even had a degree in economics, which I find quite astonishing. You can go into other areas as well. And I think it's a bit, I hate overkill when it comes to government. You've got to let sometimes the markets decide. You've got to let people decide what's right or wrong. Because really, people that run their own companies, for example, don't waste their own money if they can help it. governments, it seems a lot of wastage because it's not really their money. Whether it's got a note on the end of it, to them, it's only marks on paper, if you understand. It's just a number. When they lose X amount, a million on something, or a billion even, which we've seen recently, haven't we? It's just to them. It's like that, they'd still be able to go out and eat and do what they want to do. But for a lot of people, it makes a big difference. So I believe it's horses for courses. Government should not be running anything, in my opinion. They should leave that to the general market, because I believe markets find a level where things should be done. And even with something like, let's touch on this National Health Service, the government should be nowhere near it. Absolutely. They should, obviously, they finance it, but they should have other professionals in running it and not MPs thinking what they could do. Get the professionals in, get the old matrons in the National Health Service, they know what's doing, get the doctors in, let them run it. Obviously, they have to work out the finances, but that's all the government should do, make sure there's no wastage. And we know with the government running it, there's so much wastage, especially on procurement. Why has no one really talked about that? I will talk about that. So I'm blue in the face, procurement, when they're paying a pound for a Disprin when I can buy it for 10p or 5p at Boots. Yeah.
That's where I want to go to after the break. I want to actually talk to you about government procurement, as well as I'll tear myself away from my desperate attempt to get you to fund my film. I'll talk about desperate and some would say transparent attempt to try and do that. I asked those questions because we actually have an independent filmmaker later on the program who's made a film about Guantanamo Bay and torture. But after the break, I want to talk with you about how you would run procurement. And I'm asking that question because we've been fed up to their back teeth with comments about economy from the Conservatives and Labour, and I can't tell the difference. Also, lots of comments coming in. I'll read them after the break as well, not least about cholesterol. I'll read that for you as well. You're listening to the Lembotopic Show here on today's News Talk TNT. See you after the break.
My baby's back from the West Coast.
Hear those pictures that you asked for your school project? First day of school, cute as a button.
So long ago.
Oh, here's Grandma Florence after that flood wiped out the whole neighborhood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Ah, those beans smell heavenly.
Mm-hmm. Give Mama a little credit.
You know what? We should make an emergency communication plan. That way we're ready this year.
Oh, thank great you.
Idea. At my dorm, we have emergency kits for earthquakes and wildfires, but I'm sure there's something more local I can send you with the link.
Okay.
Smart.
I'm coming to share with you guys.
Protect your legacy. Plan for natural disasters today. Visit ready.gov/plan.
Even the thought of dementia can feel scary. It's why we put off getting help, even though we've noticed changes in our thinking or memory. But an early diagnosis can change everything, giving you medical help and a support system around you to help you live better. Start with Dementia Australia's online checklist, because the sooner you know, the more you can do.
You're with Lembotopic on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Lembotopic Show here at today's News Talk TNT. This is a digression because I mentioned cholesterol. I will read it out, though, because it's interesting. Maybe a subject for another day. Morgan says, don't believe that cholesterol nonsense, Lembit. Cholesterol is 85% produced by the body. It's essential for brain function. Statins prevent the production of cholesterol, possibly. That's why we have so much dementia and Alzheimer's these days. That's scary. That's a scary thought, Mogden. I'll take it seriously. I happen to like oats. I don't think they do me any harm. I'm not on statins. I don't really want to get onto statins. Lord Melbury agrees with that comment, with Mogden's comment. And a few more here. No swearing today, lamb chop, says Holly. You don't normally swear anyway, Holly. I know that. But you can do it. You just put it down there. But otherwise, people want to hear the bad words. They're going to have to go to the chat. Truthful Out says, bingo, as we suspected, war loans, equals banks equals globalists equals death and destruction to us all. And that's what I'm going to be talking with Melvin about. And Hermetica, we fat chugs says porridge is the food of the deities. Yes, that's because you're from Scotland, we fat chug. I have to say, I love it. I really love porridge with a little bit of honey, I admit, but there we go. Everything televised apart from the war in Ukraine, apparently, says Holly. Oats must be organic, says Hermetica. They spray oats with glyphosate to dry them. That bothers me. I have major concerns about this. Truth Will Out says, yes, Emma, the revolution is being televised, but with deception and lies. The truth is hidden and only available to us who find, listen, and or watch the alternate media. And folks who do the podcasts to get the people who are professionals, who know the truth of what's going on in reality. And a lot of conversation about oats. But let's go back to the question, which I am to ask you. Hermetica says, what does Melvin think about the state of the entertainment industry, the demonic stuff that's creeping in? Melvin, this is because I doubt whether you demeaned yourself by watching last week's Eurovision Song Contest, but there was essentially a satanic ritual together with some exceptionally tasteless and lewd sexual performances, which had no merit as far as I could see at all, certainly in my opinion. What do you think of the state of the entertainment industry?
We're talking about last week, Lemby. I did see some of it. I don't normally be honest with you, but I did see some of it. And I think if that would have been shown in Soho, it would have been banned. It was that bad. Even Soho wouldn't have accepted that, let's face it. They're just pushing out the boundaries. What can we get away with? How can we actually get people talking about us by doing something as vile as we possibly can? As I say, it's something that it's supposed to be entertaining. It wasn't entertaining. I didn't watch it all because I can't do it. I just couldn't do it. But what I did see, you had to turn it off or change channels after a while because it was something that I don't want to see. And I'd be embarrassed for the people making it. We know why they're doing it. They want to get out on the front page looking as stupid as ever, but they don't care because their name's out there. We know who they are. So, no, it's just, it's ridiculous. Even our entry, I mean, come on. That was X-rated, in my opinion. Yeah. I don't think you'd get away with that. In any other media type, you'd get away with that. In any other format. If you did that at a football match, a half-time entertainment, or you did that at whatever sporting event, imagine doing that at the London Palladium, Lemby. Can you imagine that? The London Palladium with the Queen, the King now. Can you imagine that? Absolutely disgraceful.
I was watching it with my six-year-old and I switched it over, distracted her. And luckily she wasn't really paying attention at the time when the UK entry was on. In the old days, I used to watch it for its kitschness, for its innocence, for its family fun entertainment, an excuse to let the kids stay up late, as I was allowed to stay up late when I was young, because they'd finish it on the dot of midnight, if I recall correctly. And now I would not let my children watch that. They've lost I might watch it just so that I can make a complaint next year, but I think it was absolutely disgraceful. In terms of the entertainment industry generally, Lord Melbury says many brilliant films and documentaries have been made independently on a shoestring budget. The key there is getting a good team around you who are with you and will contribute their skills for free. It does happen. And Lord Melbury, my fourth guest, will talk about that, actually. Hermetica says, yes, for a course. For example, the movie The Cold Truth is an excellent documentary. The director gave his time for free. I saw that film. I met the director. It was a real honor, actually. So to what extent in the filmmaking world, and we'll go back to that for a minute, is it just a kind of a sort of vast money laundering scheme where you've got lots of money, you want to avoid tax, not evade it, it's not illegal. You know that the film might make a loss, but you kind of wash your money through it and get it out the other end, paying less tax than you would otherwise.
I'm not too sure about that because I'm not at that cutting edge, and I'm not sure if it would make sense anyway to a degree. I think that nowadays with the with finance, everything has got to be, if someone's put money up, Lembit, someone puts 2 million up, they want to know where every penny's gone, it's recorded. So unless they're doing it themselves, which you might imply, I doubt it. I, I don't think that's there's money laundering going on and in a lot of other places in bigger money that is not spoken about, and probably we know why that is. But I don't think there's such a, I don't think, and I could be wrong, I might be out of my something or else, but I don't think there is. I don't think there might be, but I don't see it as a primary thing, primary issue. Yeah. Other areas, yes.
Now, I work on the assumption that the film that I'm trying to make will make money. It's a labor of love, really. I've been working on it for a few years. An idea hatched during the COVID lockdown, actually. It's kind of a distraction, which has now led to, well, you've even seen some of it before. One more question about a comment about the gilt markets. And then I want to talk about government procurement, because that's really one of the things I meant to start with, but we got distracted by an absolutely brilliant biographical account of the markets. Truthwell Out says, as in the gilts market, originated from banksters and their industrial military complexes. There's a feeling, and this leads us to what I wanted to ask you about, there's a feeling that the military industrial complex wags the dog of government, and that a lot of this procurement is driven by them, and that our war efforts are driven by people who know that as soon as you make a weapon and fire it, it has to be replaced. If you were the Chancellor, or if you were the Prime Minister, what would you change about procurement? And is it about a change in policy, or is it about a change in the actual procurement process itself?
If you're talking about procurement regarding war or the National Health Service and stuff like that?
Well, I was thinking about war just now, because we keep getting told it's a difficult time. But as soon as you launch a large aircraft, a Typhoon or something, it must cost at least £5,000 an hour to keep that thing in the sky, probably more. And no one ever bats an eyelid about the amount of fuel it's using and everything else. And then I know that in the NHS sense, we can talk about this, they spent something like £12 billion on an integrated information technology system that never was implemented because it didn't work. But let's start with the military. Is there a problem of procurement in the military, or is there a problem of policy, or neither?
I think procurement is a big, big question mark in the military. You've got to remember, anywhere there's big money, there's going to be problems. Anywhere you're looking at something where you don't know, the public has got no idea what the cost is. You can put any figure you like out there and say we spent X, Y, or Z. You don't know what a rocket, you just said 5,000. It could be 50,000, it could be whatever you like, we don't know. There's all different types of rockets, perhaps. Therefore, we have got no idea in the real world what is going on with procurement regarding war. And when you've got such a big market with so much money at stake, and you're tugging at people's heartstrings, we've got to defend the country, we've got to do this, we've got to defend this country and that country, people go, well, we can't be seen not to say we don't agree with that. So they get a blank check, in my opinion. They get it and they spend it how they want. And you don't know if they spend $50 billion a year. How do you know what it's spent on? Can you tell me what it's, if they've spent $50 billion or they've spent $46 billion and $4 billion has gone to a fixer? You don't know. I'm not saying it happens. I'll be wrong to say that, but you don't know. So procurement in war, that I would say. But if I can just go back to the NHS and councils, Lembit. I was slightly involved in councils, as you know. And the best thing you could do, if you're a local businessman, you know what it is get a contract with a council. They will pay you the wrong price. They will pay you double, probably. And not only will they pay you double in some circumstances, you'll get a five-year contract, which can't be changed. And I've seen it time and time again, where you're thinking, we paid what for what? Who passed that? And all of a sudden, everything goes a blur after that, doesn't it? The same when you say procurement of the National Health Service with discipline. And you remember how the market should work. If you're buying 100,000 of something, you get it at X. If you go and buy a million of something, you get it at less than X. But the National Health Service works on the other way around. They're buying lumps and they got to pay 5-10 times more. So, and this has been going on through governments. Every government, the last, 20-30 years, has allowed it to continue. And you've got to have a question mark. Why are they letting this? Someone's getting something somewhere. I don't know. I don't know. Perhaps I'm being a bit silly.
No, I'm agreeing with you. When I was a member of parliament, I just couldn't believe the profligacy. I had the sense that a lot of the frontline staff in the National Health Service in the UK really are totally committed to life-saving and life-improving. Yeah. Then you got a bunch of middle managers who are interested in getting the 130,000 a year or whatever it is. And I just had the feeling that it's back to what you said before. Government politicians can't just do the job because they're politicians. And because we don't have specialists in there, doctors in the NHS, in the Ministry for Health, military people in the Department of Defense, transport experts in the Department of Transport, they just get taken for a ride. And we get taken for a ride because it's actually not their money, it's our money. That's what I think happens. And in the business that you've been in the financing world that you've been in, you would never, ever tolerate that kind of behavior. They'd be out in their ear.
But you know what is quite interesting? When I first went into the market, my firm was run by partners. Now, the big difference is, if there's partners, it's their own money. They're not going to take risks with other people's money. So therefore, everything that they did, they made sure it's for the good of the company. Whereas going back within the leases of this world and people like that, what happens is that they can afford to take a bigger risk with the firm's money, because if it goes wrong, they don't lose. They might lose their job, but it's not going to cost them out of their pocket. They'd probably get another job. But if they take a bigger risk and it goes right, they're going to get an enormous bonus. So they don't do it full heartedly, but they take a risk where if it was their own money, they wouldn't. That's why I think partnerships in certain firms are so, so important.
Because you're a stakeholder in the game. I actually think the same of politics, exactly. Incidentally. I think the problem you've got is that you can mess up in transport and still go and run health, mess up in health as well.
Yes, yeah.
Just looking ahead then, what would be your advice to the voting public when it comes to looking at the difference between the Labour Party and the Conservatives? Because to be honest with you, I can't see the economic difference.
There's probably no, we can't see in the future, but we think we know what might happen. There's no difference, but I'm a Conservative, as you probably know, but I don't think I can vote for them for two reasons. Number one, they've let the country down, but more so, they've let the Labour in. And I don't, there's nothing between them. And really, to let the Labour in, and I don't think they'd be any good, but I think if I had to toss a coin, I'd never vote for Labour. Not this current Labour. I might do in the future, who knows? But the current Labour, I look at them and go, my God, they're doing all the same things Labour have always done. The way they're talking, the way they're talking down to people. I'm saying the Conservatives have done it as well, to be quite honest. But I'm so upset with the Conservatives if they were going to let, the Conservatives were poor, they were going to let a decent Labour in. I'd go, you know what, fair dues, give them a chance. But they know what they're letting in. And they've done nothing to stop it. How many times have you heard people say, become more conservative? The last year, year and a half. Yeah. Come on, Rishi, become more conservative. And he's gone like that. No, can't see anything, can't hear. No. Well, it's just ridiculous, so stubborn. So if I had to choose between the two, not that I'd vote, but I'd say, you know what? If you ask me for the public, I suppose for doubt, you vote for the Labour to give them a chance to muck it up, which I think they probably will.
All right, then I'll buy a property abroad before it's too late. A few comments here before you go. We've had Chuck tends to agree with you. How many billions for a useless app? He asks. Truth will out, who owns anything that creates vast monies? The banksters. Who own the banksters? The globalists. And Lord Melbury says, anywhere there's big money, there's big corruption. So many dirty fingers dipping their fingers in the pot. But not yours. Your fingers are clean and untainted, Melvin Marks. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today. Really appreciate it. And just remember, when it comes to my film, gives a job. I'll tell you more about my film after Melvin's gone. There's quite a lot of interest in it. There's not a secret. I'll tell you about it. And also, I'll put some of your music questions to my next guest, Jim Lawton, who will be joining us after the break. You're watching Lambertopic on The Lambertopic Show right here on Today's News Talk TNT. Don't go anywhere. I'll see you after the break.